listening to the hashtag STRAsk podcast. This is a podcast from Stand to Reason, where I, Amy Hall, come with Greg Kokel to answer your questions that you send on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. But you can also send those questions through our website. I just want to make that clear. We actually get quite a few questions through our website because I don't think a whole lot of people are actually on Twitter. Twitter is kind of a smaller subsection of humanity. So if you have a question, feel free to go through our website. You just have to choose, I have another question when you have the choice, and put hashtag STRAsk, that's all one word, hashtag STRASK, into your question, and it goes directly into a folder that I will see. So we thank you for your questions. All right. Greg, are you ready?
Sure.
Okay.
Rock and roll.
Here's a question from Brooke Stock. What exactly does Jesus mean when he says, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place, referring to the tribulation and signs of Christ's coming? Yeah. These words are slightly unsettling since it seems like these signs already should have happened.
Right. And it's a mysterious statement. Let's just start out like that. And it's not entirely clear how to take it. All I could do is give a couple of options. One he meant is all the people hearing won't die until this all happens. And by the way, that's the way some people take it. And these are called preterists, and they believe that everything Jesus predicted there in the Olivet Discourse, where this appears, Matthew 24, Mark 11, I think it's maybe Luke 19, or Luke 21, are the parallel passages, that everything Jesus predicted there has already taken place. And even the signs that he talks about in the sky took place around the time the temple was destroyed. And it does seem that some of the things that Jesus predicts there do relate to the destruction of the temple. And there's kind of a curious circumstance there, because when Jerusalem was besieged, I think it started in 69, and somebody like Trajan or whatever was in charge of that, and then the emperor died, and Trajan was next in succession, so he left, and the military withdrew, and then Titus returned later to complete the siege and take over the city. And that matches something that Jesus says when you see the armies surrounding Jerusalem flee to the hills. Well, when you're under siege, you can't flee to the hills, but this gave an opportunity for the Christians to do that and flee to maybe Petra or wherever they did. And so there do seem to be things in that passage that had historical fulfillment during that time. But like a lot of these prophetic things, there are sometimes dual fulfillments. Something is going to happen momentarily, soon, historically speaking, but this prefigures something coming in the end, just like John the Baptist. Well, he was Elijah, kinda, but there's also an Elijah to come. All right, and we see in the book of Revelation something that parallels that. So you have a kind of dual fulfillment. And this is a way of looking at it, that what Jesus is talking about when he says these things, well, I think he uses the phrase, all these things will happen in this generation, that he's talking about some of these main things, but there's also another fulfillment of this. And part of my response to the preterists who say, yes, it's all, second coming has happened, as this is it? For the last 2,000 years, this is the blessed hope? Really? Bummer. That's my response to it. So I don't think the preterists who think that all of that has been fulfilled are right, for what seems to me very obvious reasons. Another way of taking it is that this people or this generation, I'm thinking of, there's another way of translating that phrase, meaning these peoples, the Jewish people, will not pass away until these things have taken place. That's a possibility. It doesn't seem to be a strong one. An alternate way is saying when Jesus is talking about this generation, he is talking about the generation that is being described as characterized by all the signs that he just mentions. So when you have this group of signs taking place in unison, then you have the you're a generation away or so, something along that line, from Jesus returning visibly and powerfully and conclusively to this earth. And that's the way I take the wording of the Olivet Discourse. He comes visibly. You don't have to be, nobody's got to tell you he's here, he's there, he's in the outer room, he's in the field. Jesus says that because his coming will be like the lightning from the east to the west. I don't think he's speaking metaphorically there, because I don't know what his point would be then if he's not, doesn't mean this in a straightforward fashion. Don't look for me here or there because everyone will see. So it's visible. It's also powerful, coming in the clouds with power and great glory. And it's also conclusive. This is the end. Okay? That seems to be the way things are described. So it could be that the congregation, the aggregation of all of these activities or signs that Jesus is describing there happens in the space of a generation. Now, frankly, I'm not satisfied fully with any of those. For me, there's a kind of a mystery to it. They say, some of those say, okay, well, that kind of makes sense, but I don't know. Keep in mind, though, you're dealing with a prophetic utterance that has to do with future events. And these are always a little bit goofy, screwy, hard to figure out. Look at the things about Jesus. Even those things cited in the New Testament from the Old Testament that pertain to the coming of Christ. When you go back to the Old Testament and read those passages, you think, wait a minute, I wouldn't get the sense if I was a Jew reading this in its original context, that this is really referring to the Messiah to come many years hence. This is just one of the kind of strange characteristics of prophetic utterance, prophecy that relates to the future, resolution of all things, whether the first or the second coming of Messiah. So this is why I think we have to tread lightly on it. Okay, we have our view, but we have to not be too dogmatic about it. Do you have a take on that, Amy?
I probably lean most towards the last one you mentioned, but I agree. I'm not entirely settled about what I think about this. I feel like there's something we're missing, something that we still need to make sense of this. And I don't know. Is it possible that some of what he said would be fulfilled, like partial preterism or something like that? Is that possible? Or do you mm-hmm. think the passage right. makes it sound like it's all happening at that time?
No, I think partial preterism is the favored view, because it's clear that some of those details have taken place and some have not. And again, like I said, I don't think this is unusual for prophecy. Mm-hmm. You read in Daniel 9 about the 70 weeks prophecy, and after 69 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off. That means he's going to be killed, all right, 490 years. When it says weeks, it means sevens, 70 sevens. It doesn't indicate the category of sevens, and it is likely 70 sevens of years, which is 490 years, and a year in prophetic terms by other calculations, other passages, is 360 days. So you can just do the math, and it looks like from the time, the start-off point there, the decree of Artaxerxes, which to match the prophetic word was in 444 BC, you just add up the days and you get to, like, it looks like the triumphal entry. So this is uncanny how this is fulfilled. However, then there's another 7 years that clearly haven't taken place yet, because at the end of the 7 remaining years, it is the culmination of all things, according to Daniel's details. That hasn't happened yet. So this looks like there's like this pause in the prophetic timetable between the 490 years and the last 7 years, okay, and that pause is characteristically identified as the church age. So you have a fulfillment at one time, and the rest of the fulfillment is some time way later, if that's an accurate way of looking at it, at least 2,000 years later. All right, so it would not be unusual then, when you consider how prophecy works, that kind of prophecy, that there is a split fulfillment now and later, some now, some later. So I think partial preterism, that means part of it's already been fulfilled in the past, that and some remains to be fulfilled in the future, is probably the safest way to go.
And there are even prophecies in the Old Testament that are fulfilled twice, one in a smaller way and one in a greater way. So I'm thinking of the prophecies about David's house, or the prophecy about Solomon, or prophecies about that were fulfilled in, you know, I'm trying to think of the specific one about Solomon or your son, or it's fulfilled in Solomon in a smaller way, but then later on is fulfilled in Jesus in a much larger way. So maybe it's something like that. I don't have a whole lot of knowledge of end times. That's just not one of the subjects I'm really fascinated by, because I feel like I have the main ideas down. Jesus is coming back. We will be judged. You know, things will be difficult. I think I got the main ideas. So it's not something I spend a whole lot of time on, but I was really interested to hear what you thought, Greg. So thank you. Let's go on to a question from Doug Smith. Prayer seems easier for my wife than me. Please discuss.
Well, based on what I know about your wife, she is much more spiritual than you are, Doug. And that explains it. This is very clearly to me a matter of individual temperaments. Now, from what I understand, I've talked about my own, what's the right word? First word that came to mind is struggles with prayer, but that's probably not the most precise. I certainly have written about how prayer is difficult. I've written a number of times about that, and how there are things that we can do to make our own individual prayer lives more consistent and more ordered so that they get done. Somebody says, well, you know, working out is difficult. I said, okay, look, don't worry about thinking about working out. First, do this stretch, then do 10 push-ups, and then do some jumping. So if you have a plan, working out isn't quite so difficult. You follow the plan one after another. And so there are things that I've recommended that I've also got from other people, and some unique things that I've written about in mentoring letters that many of you have received to help make your prayer lives more consistent and satisfying. That I've employed in my life, okay? But then there are other people, you know, I'm looking at Amy, and my suspicion, just from what we talked about, Amy, in the past, is that your prayer life maybe comes more naturally for you, and it's more easy for you to enter into prayer. Lots of very spiritually mature and productive people have struggled with prayer. C.S. Lewis, for example, and I in the pieces I've written, I mentioned things that he has said. John Piper talks about,
are you talking about John Newton?
John Newton does, yeah. Too. I mentioned him, but I was thinking about the Presbyterian pastor in New York City.
Tim Keller.
Tim Keller talks about this. So it is a fairly common experience for Christians to struggle. And I think the way I'm trying to remember who put it this way, and maybe it is whether it was Newton or Lewis, but he said, I'm loath to go to prayer, and then I'm loath to stay once I get there. And for me, prayer is like writing. It's hard to do, but I'm glad when I've done it. the satisfaction comes when I'm done, because I know that it's covered. And this, and Scripture says, "You have not because you ask not." And I, even this today in my prayer, as I'm driving here, I'm thinking, God, you know, I've prayed about these things that I'm about to mention so many times, but I'm not going to stop asking. I'm just not going to stop. So far, you have not responded, but I, at least to the particulars, and I'm not going to stop, and so I'm going to keep going, and so, but that's me, and it may be Doug, okay, but different people have different personalities, and for some people, it's just prayer is easy. It's just native to their personality profile or something. It's just easy for them. I don't know, do you struggle, Amy, or is it, would you say it's easier than you've heard me talk about it, or how would you characterize it for yourself personally?
Well, this might be helpful to Doug, because I've had times when prayer has gone really well. It's been easy. I've looked forward to it. I could sit there for an hour. It seemed really fruitful. I was seeing answers. And then I have times when I just don't want to pray, and I really struggle. So I would not assume that if you're having a hard time right now, that it will be that way forever. I think it's something that changes over time, depending on what you're going through and experiencing. Maybe if you're less disciplined, that's something I do find, Greg. When I start off, if I haven't been praying well for a while and I start off again, it's always the hardest at the beginning. But the more you do it regularly, it does come more naturally and easy. But again, if you take a break or you slow down, you gotta start pushing that rock up the hill again. But then as soon as you get going and you're experiencing
Sisyphus.
It, yes. It does get a little better. And one thing, I also think it waxes and wanes depending on how much hope I'm feeling that God will answer my prayers. I'm not saying that's the way it should be. I'm just saying, just personally, the less you think God is listening or hearing or will change things, the harder it is to pray. And I think we have to figure out why we're praying, what our goal is. But one thing I would say, and this, when I was having a very difficult time several years ago, one thing that really helped me was a verse in Romans 4 when it's talking about Abraham. And here's what it says. This is starting in verse 17. "As it is written, a father of many nations have I made you, in the presence of him whom he believed, even God, who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist." And what helped me was knowing, okay, I don't really think God's going to change this that I'm praying for, but he is the God who calls into being that which does not exist. And if you can just hope in that, and hope in who he is, you don't have to hope that he's going to do what you ask, because he might not. He might have no intention of doing that. But if you can hope in who he is, that is the God who calls into being that which does not exist, that is where you can start.
That's good advice. It got me thinking about something else, something you said when you, it sounded to me like you intimated when you are trying to come out of a season of poor prayer and getting started to be more consistent again, it's hard to get going. And I presume you meant it's hard to get the new season going, but you have to build consistency doing it right. I think it's also in individual occasions of prayer, it's hard to get going as well. And I found for myself, I mean, you have the Lord's Prayer, and that starts with God and his glory. Okay, and I think that's how Jesus instructed us to pray. Father, and hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. By the way, when I think about your will be done, it's this moral will, because a sovereign will is going to be done in both places. That means your moral will, the goodness, your goodness on earth. Well, how's that on earth? Well, I think about my country, and that's when I pray about my country. And also, I think on earth, where is my earth? It's where I put my feet. And the place where I put my feet most meaningfully is in my own home. So I want God's will in my life and in my wife's life and in my daughter's lives. And that's, you know, that kind of segues into me praying for them. But I will tell you, sometimes the best place for me to start is with what is on my emotional heart at the moment. If it's hard to get going, you know, don't worry about the system. Just start talking to God. Just cry out. And if there's an individual who needs your prayer, I'm thinking of a number right now. I'll just start there because I'm somewhat emotionally invested in some of that. And if the things that I pray for regularly that I haven't been seeing answers for, and that is discouraging to me, keeps me from praying vigorously for them again. If I start somewhere else in something I just feel more confident of and start talking, then, and this happened this morning, then after about 10 minutes of praying like that, I felt like I could go back to these other issues from which I haven't been getting answers and present them before the Lord with more conviction, because it's kind of like you're warmed up, right? You know, like if you're jogging or something, it's the first, you know, quarter mile that's the absolute worst. But then you get warmed up a little bit. I think something similar happens in prayer. So that would be a recommendation to Doug. Or Doug, ask your wife. What is she? Ask her about what makes it easier for her. Now, she may be able to tell you or maybe not. She might say, I don't know, it just is. I love going before the Lord. Well, that's a temperamental thing, and you're not going to match that. Don't try. But there may be some things you can do that will get you going. Here's one thing you could do. Here's another. It is very easy, all right? Since the number one emphasis in the New Testament regarding prayer is on thanksgiving, that is, there are verses about it, and there are also lots of occasions where Paul is praying prayers of thanksgiving. You know, I thank God, blah, blah, blah. That's a great place to start. Just think about what you are thankful for. And, you know, I'm driving to work or I'm going to the office. I'm driving my 2014 F-150. You know, I love my, what the girls call a bubble. I love my big truck. You know, I thank God for my F-150. You know, and I thank God for this beautiful route that I get to take through Malibu Canyon to Malibu and along the coast on my way to the office. You know, I think of the things that I'm genuinely thankful for. And you know what ends up happening? I end up thinking about some of my trials and thanking God for those too. So you start with a period of thanksgiving. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. Just keep thanking God for specifics in your life. And that's another way to just get warmed up, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Part of the problem, I think, even though we're regenerated as Christians, we're still fallen people and there's still distance between us and God. And I think that's also part of the reason why when you leave for a while and you come back, there's that hesitation. You're coming before a holy God. You feel a little bit separated from him. You feel a little bit distant. This is true with any person, any friend that you haven't talked to in a long time. This is a real relationship. And so if you haven't talked to someone in a long time, it'll take a little bit to get warmed up as you're starting to talk. So that isn't all that surprising, I guess. All right. Well, thank you, Greg, for your thoughts. Thank you for your questions, Doug and Brooke. And we look forward to hearing from you. Send in your question on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.